Mrs. Nesbit's medicine cabinet. I gave Matt his first, and his cough subsided enough that he was able to help me give the medicine to Johnny and Mom. I was afraid to take it myself in case the codeine put me to sleep. Instead, I grabbed a washcloth and threw it into a water pot. Once it was thoroughly wet, I covered my mouth with it and went back into the sunroom. Panic overwhelmed me. The room was filled with smoke, and breathing was close to impossible. I couldn't think what to do next. We were all going to die, and it would be all my fault. I got really mad then, and that pushed me into action. The first thing I did was open the back door to air the room out. That was one piece of good luck. The wind was blowing in the right direction. I stayed outside long enough to get some air back into my lungs. Good thing I'd been sleeping with my coat on, but even so, I couldn't manage more than a minute since I didn't have any shoes on. Still, that was enough air to get me back into the sunroom. I tried opening the skylights, but there was too much snow on top of them. I cursed myself for not having gotten on the ladder to clear them off when the snow had started, but it was too late now. I pulled the plywood off one of the windows opposite the door and opened the window. The crosswind worked, and I started to see the smoke lessening. I knew what I had to do next, and that was get rid of the piece of wood that had caused the backfire. I went to the door, took a few deep breaths, then came back in and opened the wood stove. The smoke was overwhelming. I raced back outside and grabbed a handful of snow to rub against my burning eyes. I swallowed some of the snow. Mom'll kill me, I thought, drinking unboiled snow. The thought made me laugh, and that got me coughing again. I laughed and cried and coughed and choked, but in spite of it all, I was damned if I was going to die, and I was double damned if I was going to leave Matt and John and Mom like that. So I went back into the sunroom. The smoke was still incredibly thick, and I thought I'd cough my lungs up. I crawled over to the stove and put on the mitts. I reached in and pulled out the smoking log. Even through the mitt, I could tell the log was wet. Hot and wet and steaming and smoking. I juggled it between the mitts, crawled to the door, and threw it out. The log shouldn't have been wet. We hadn't had that problem with any of the wood Matt and Johnny have cut up until now. I realized the stove had to be wet. Snow or ice must have fallen through the chimney and made the entire stove damp. I had to make sure the stove was dry, or else the same thing would happen again. And that meant I had to get another fire going just to dry out the stove. And that meant more smoke. My whole body began to shake. It was stupid, but I kept thinking how unfair it was. Why did I have to be the one? Why couldn't I be sick and Matt take care of me? Or John? He's the one who gets to eat. Why did he have to get sick? He should be healthy. He should be the one choking to death, and I should be in the nice warm kitchen all drugged with codeine. Well, it was useless to dream. I looked around the sunroom to see what I could burn. A log wouldn't do. It would just get wet and start the whole business over again. I needed to burn lots and lots of paper. My first thought was the textbooks, but I knew Mom would kill me. If we all got well and she found we couldn't keep studying, she would kill me. I felt like if I had to go through all this, I should be rewarded by burning a textbook. I left the sunroom and made my way through the kitchen. Everyone was still coughing, but not the way they had been. Matt looked feverish, but he waved me away when I tried to hover. "I'm okay," he whispered. I didn't have much choice but to believe him. I went upstairs and got a couple of the textbooks I'd taken home my one day at school. While I was up there, I changed into dry clothes and put on shoes. Just doing that helped. I went back to the kitchen and freshened the washcloth. Then I crawled back into the sunroom. The smoke had lessened, but once I reopened the wood stove, it poured out again. I tore page after page from the textbook. With a shaking hand, I lit a match and threw the burning paper into the stove. The smoke grew stronger, and I wasn't sure I'd be able to bear it. But I shoved as many pieces of paper as I could in there, and when I was sure the fire would last at least a minute, I let myself go to the back door and gulp in some air. Then I went back, tore more sheets out, and burned them. I don't know how long I burned paper, but I know I killed 1.5 textbooks. If the school wants them back, they can just sue me. Finally, the stove stopped smoking. I tore some more textbook, then piled on some of my kindling. When the fire was going good and strong, I put a couple of logs in, and everything was fine. I took a pot and filled it with snow and put it on top of the stove to get some moisture back in the room. I waited about half an hour, and then I closed the window. I waited another half hour after that, watching the fire and making sure it was burning clean before I closed the door. I wanted more than anything to curl up on the kitchen floor and go to sleep, but I didn't dare leave the wood stove untended. So I stayed awake and only left the sunroom to go into the kitchen a couple of times to check on Mom and Matt and Johnny. The window I took the plywood off of has an eastern exposure. I can see the sky lightening, so I guess it's dawn. It really isn't January 13th anymore. I'm going to leave everyone in the kitchen for the time being. I'll give them their aspirin and let them go back to sleep. It's taken hours for the house to get from below freezing to 65 degrees, and they might as well enjoy it. Besides, the sunroom still stinks of smoke, and I really should open the window and the door and air things out. We'll be sleeping on smoky mattresses for weeks to come. Because if this didn't kill us, nothing will. It's January 14th, and I can see the dawn, and we're all going to survive. January 14th. We're all still alive. I'm scared to leave everyone in the kitchen, and I'm scared to move them back. What scares me most is I don't think Matt has the strength to help me get them into the sunroom. I'm just going to hope we have enough heating oil to make it through the night. I stink of smoke, and it hurts to breathe. January 15th. After I gave Mom her morning aspirin, I bent over her and kissed her forehead. It was just like Sleeping Beauty. Mom opened her eyes, stared straight at me, and said, "Not until you finish your homework." I burst out laughing. "Don't laugh at me, young lady," Mom said. "Yes, ma'am," I said, trying with all my strength not to. "Very well," she said. "I'll make supper now." She struggled to get up. "No, that's okay," I said. "I'm not hungry." "Nonsense," she said, but she fell back asleep. Her breathing was steady, and I could tell her fever had broken. She woke up a few hours later and seemed puzzled to be in the kitchen. "Is everyone all right?" she asked. "We're fine," I told her. She looked over and saw John and Matt sleeping on the floor. "What are we doing here?" she asked. "What's going on?" "There was a problem with the wood stove," I said. "So I turned the furnace on, and you've been sleeping in here."
"You look terrible," she said. "Are you eating properly?"
"No," I said. Mom nodded. "Well, none of us are," she said, and went back to sleep. When she woke up this evening, she was just about normal. She managed to sit up, and she asked how each of us was doing. I gave her the rundown. "How long have we been sick?" she asked. "I don't know," I said. "I've lost track. A few days."
"And you took care of us all that time?" she asked. "By yourself?"
"Matt helped," I said. I wanted to collapse by her side and weep and have her hold me and comfort me. None of which, of course, could I do. "The real problem was the wood stove, but that's okay now. Maybe tomorrow you'll move back to the sunroom."
"When did you eat last?" she asked.
"I haven't been hungry," I said. "I'm okay."
"You need to eat," she said. "We can't have you getting sick.
Get yourself a can of mixed vegetables and eat all of it." "Mom," I said. "That's an order," she said. So I did, and when I finished the can of vegetables, I realized I was famished. I went back to the pantry and made myself a can of carrots and ate all of that. I probably haven't eaten in a couple of days, so I guess I'm entitled. Then I realized Mom was well enough to eat, so I heated up a can of soup and gave her some. Matt woke up and he ate along with her.
"I'm worried about Johnny," Mom said when she finished her soup. "Do you think you should get Peter and have him check him out?"
"I've already been to the hospital," I said. "I went the first day you all got sick. It's the flu,
and the only thing we can do is wait it out. I'd still feel better if Peter could see him, Mom said. I know you've been doing everything you can, but Peter's a doctor. It's too late for me to go anyplace today, I said. Let's see how Johnny is tomorrow, okay? Now, go back to sleep. Thank goodness Mom did. With everything that's happened, I haven't even thought how to tell her Peter died. January 16th. Johnny woke me this morning. I was sleeping in the doorway, head in the sunroom, feet in the kitchen. I'm hungry, he said. He was weak, but he was Johnny. I'll get you some soup, I said. I got up, went to the pantry, pulled out a can of soup, and heated it on the wood stove. He was able to sit up and eat most of it. While he was eating, Mom and Matt both woke up. I heated more soup for them, and soon they were all sitting up, eating, and even talking. Shouldn't we move back to the sunroom? Mom asked. Later, I said. Let me change the sheets on your mattresses first. I went upstairs and got fresh sheets. I would have liked to flip all the mattresses over, but I didn't have the strength, so I told myself it wouldn't matter. Once I got the clean sheets on the mattresses, I helped everyone get up. First Matt, then Mom, and finally Johnny. They all collapsed onto their mattresses. The walk from the kitchen to the sunroom took a lot out of them. But after they'd napped, they woke up, and I could see the difference in all of them. I heated up some vegetables, and they all ate. I gave everyone sponge baths, and then I took all their dirty sheets and pillowcases and spent the afternoon washing them. Since the house was still warm, I hung them all up in the kitchen and the living room. When the laundry felt damp, I turned the heat off. I probably shouldn't have kept it on as long as I did, but it was so luxurious doing the wash in a warm kitchen. Mom didn't ask about Peter. January 17th. Everyone was crabby and demanding. Get me this. Bring me that. I'm hot. I'm cold. It's too bright. It's too dark. Why did you do that? Why didn't you do that? I swear I hate them all. January 19th. I can see how much better everyone is. I'm worried most about Matt. He was never as sick as Mom or Johnny, but he's still very weak. I worry that when he helped me pull Mom and Johnny out of the sunroom, he might have strained his heart. Mom and Johnny both walked a few steps today. January 21st. I'm feeding everybody three meals a day. It's probably suicidal, but it's just so wonderful to see them eat. Mom says tomorrow she's going to be strong enough to do the cooking. John asked for his baseball cards, and he stayed up all afternoon organizing them. Matt asked me to bring him a murder mystery, and he spent the day reading it. This evening, Matt told me not to worry about the fire. He'd make sure to keep it going during the night. I should just get a good night's sleep. I'm going to take him up on that. January 23rd. I guess I slept for two straight days. I feel real groggy and hungry. Mom's making me a cup of tea. Matt and John are playing chess. Even Horton is sleeping on my mattress. I think we're going to be okay. January 26th. I climbed onto the roof today and cleared the snow off. It's been on my list of things to do since that awful night, but I wanted to make sure someone would be strong enough to rescue me if I got into trouble. John's getting stronger faster than Mom or Matt. By this afternoon, I figured I could take my chances. It was hard work, and I can't imagine how much harder it must have been after the blizzard when there was so much more snow. I'm actually doing everybody's work these days. Snow removal and all the laundry, etc. But tomorrow, John'll start doing the dishes. He's eager to do stuff, but we all agree it's better for him to take things slow and make sure he recovers fully. Mom wasn't crazy about his being outside all the time I did the roof cleaning, but I worked as fast as I could, and John doesn't seem any the worse for it. I'm more tired than I used to be, but I think that'll pass. The important thing is, I didn't get sick, and we all think if I didn't then, I'm not going to now. Me, and Maggie and Linda. I hope they had as good luck with their families as I did with mine. January 27th. I was in the kitchen doing laundry when Mom joined me. You shouldn't be here, I said. Go back to the sunroom.
I will in a minute, she said. But this seemed like a good time to talk.
There was a time when that tone would have meant I was in trouble. Now it just means she wants some private conversation. I smiled at her and kept scrubbing.
I want you to know how proud I am of you, she said. There aren't words to say how grateful I am. We would have died without you, and we all know that. We owe you our lives.
You would have done the same for me, I said, staring at the dirty underwear. I knew if I looked at Mom, I'd start crying. And I didn't want to do that, because I worry if I start crying, I'll never stop.
You're a very special girl, Mom said.
No, you're a very special woman, Miranda. Thank you.
You're welcome, I said.
Is that it? Because if it is, you really should go back to the sunroom.
There is one other thing, she said. I'm confused about something. Those first few days, well, everything is hazy in my mind. Was Peter here? I think I remember you going to get him, but I don't remember seeing him. Did you get to see him? Did he know we were sick? I know it's close to impossible to get from here to the hospital, so I don't even know if you made it, but did you try?
I'm sorry, I'm just trying to put all this together and make sense of it. This time I looked away from the laundry. I dried my hands off and turned to face Mom. I made it to the hospital, I said. That first day, Matt was too sick to go, so I went. Basically, I was told what I already knew, that you all had the flu and you should be kept warm and given aspirin and made comfortable until you got better. So I came back and did all that.
Did you see Peter? Mom asked.
No, I said. I spoke to two women there. Nurses, I think. I turned away from her and willed myself to be brave.
Mom, Peter's dead, I said. The nurses told me.
The flu decimated everyone at the hospital, patients and staff. You got sick on Tuesday, and he died the weekend before. I don't know for sure, but I think a lot of people in town died. Maybe people all over the country. It was that kind of flu. We were incredibly lucky you all pulled through. Well, not completely because of luck. You've seen to it we've had food and water and shelter and heat. Even Matt making us move into the sunroom when we still had heating oil probably saved your lives, because when we needed the oil, we still had some. Mom stood there stone-faced.
I'm sorry, I said. I haven't wanted to tell you. The nurses said he worked to the end. He was a hero.
I wish we didn't need so damn many heroes, Mom said, and went back to the sunroom.
Me too.
January 30th. Matt remains weak, which is really annoying him. Mom keeps telling him that people recuperate at different speeds and he should just not rush things. But I think he's never going to be 100% again. John's regained most of his strength, and he's impatient to be doing things, but Mom's keeping him on a limited schedule. Except for that one day when I cleared off the roof, he's stayed in the sunroom. Since he can wash the dishes in the old basin we found in the cellar, he doesn't even have to leave the sunroom to do that. Mom isn't as strong as I'd like her to be, but I know she's also sad about Peter. After I told her, she had me tell Matt and Johnny, too, so now everybody knows. But of course it's Mom who feels it the worst. Now that it's been a couple of weeks since the fevers broke, I figure I can do some stuff on my own. This afternoon, I took the skis and went back to the road to practice. It was glorious being alone and outside and doing something other than nursing and housework. And since my trek to the hospital, I've been thinking how I really should get better on the skis. I don't know when Matt will be strong enough to go any distance, and one of us needs to be able to get around. That leaves John and me, and I have a head start. This is my time. I've earned it. February 2nd. Mom must be getting better. She asked if I'd forgotten about schoolwork. It hasn't been my highest priority, I said. Well, we need to change that, she said, for all of us. Johnny, there's no reason why you can't go back to algebra. Matt can help you. And I'm going to forget all my French if I don't start working on it. We don't want our brains to rot away. Mom, I said. I'm doing all the housework and I'm skiing. What more do you want from me?
I don't want back talk from you, I can tell you that, she said. Now open up that history textbook and get to work. It's a good thing I didn't burn it. Or maybe it's not such a good thing.
February 4th. Matt needed something from his bedroom. It's hard for Mom to get upstairs since she fell the second time, so I go to her room if she needs something from there. John only started going upstairs last weekend. Up till then, I got whatever he needed, and of course I've been doing the same for Matt. Do you think you're ready? Mom asked him.
Sure, Matt said. I wouldn't do it if I weren't.
Mom exchanged glances with me, but when I started to get up to go with him, she shook her head ever so slightly. Matt made his way out of the sunroom, through the kitchen, down the hallway to the staircase. I don't think any of us breathed as we heard his lumbering steps on the staircase. Then the sound stopped. Go, Mom said to me. I ran to the staircase. Matt was standing 4 steps up. I can't do it, he said. Damn it to hell, I can't get up the stairs. Then stop trying, I said. Just come down and try some other time.
What if there isn't another time? He said.
What if I'm a useless invalid for the rest of my life? You may be an invalid, but you'll never be useless, I said. Matt, has it occurred to you that the reason you're so weak is because you pulled Mom and Johnny out of the sunroom that night? That maybe you sacrificed your health to save their lives, and that's something you should be proud of? They wouldn't be alive if it weren't for you. You have no idea how much you give to us every single day. You think I liked nursing all of you? I hated it. But I think of how you do things, without complaining. You just do what has to be done, and I tried to be like you. So walk down those stairs and get back to bed, and if you stay exactly the way you are now, you'll still be the strongest person I've ever known.
It takes one to know one, he said.
Great, I said. We're both the bestest people ever. Now tell me what you want upstairs and go to the sunroom before Mom gets hysterical. So he did. I watched to make sure he made it down the stairs. Then I ran upstairs and got what he needed in the first place. It's going to kill us if Matt doesn't get stronger. But he doesn't need to know that. February 7th. Mom's birthday. Christmas, when Mom had shared her candy with us, I ate 2 of the 4 pieces I took, and saved the other 2. So Mom's birthday present was 2 pieces of candy. John let her beat him in chess, and Matt walked to and from the staircase 3 times. She said it was the best birthday she'd ever had. Chapter 20. February 9th. John's strong enough to demand time on the skis, and I've run out of excuses to keep him from using them. Every morning, I go out and ski by myself for an hour or so. It keeps my mind off food, and that's good too. Then after lunch, I go out with John and watch while he skis. Mom won't let him be outside alone yet. He doesn't last more than 15 to 20 minutes, so it's really not that bad. Matt walks to and from the staircase 3 times every morning and 4 times after lunch. I think he's going to try climbing the stairs next week, just a couple at first, and then build up, however long it takes. Mom isn't ready to do laundry, but she's making our lunches again. Somehow, everything tastes better if Mom's the one who prepares it. At my insistence, and I love that I actually won an argument, we kept the plywood off the one window. Most of the snow is gone from the skylights, so there's a little more natural light in the sunroom. I don't think the air quality is much better, but I can tell the days are getting longer. There's a lot of stuff to worry about, but I've given myself a holiday. I can always worry next week instead. February 12th. I came home from my morning ski and found Mom frying something in the skillet. It smelled wonderful. We haven't had any fresh vegetables in so long, and there's no point frying canned spinach or string beans. We were practically jumping with excitement by the time Mom served lunch. I couldn't figure out what we were eating. The texture was kind of like an onion, but the taste was a little bitter. What is it? We all asked. Tulip bulbs, Mom said. I pulled them out of the ground last summer before the ground froze. I've been saving them for a nice treat. We all stopped chewing. It was almost as though Mom had sautéed Horton. Come on, Mom said. We won't be the first people to eat tulip bulbs. It was a comforting thought. That and hunger pushed us through lunch. February 14th. Valentine's Day. I wonder where Dan is. Wherever he is, he's probably not thinking of me. February 15th. Matt walked up 6 steps. We all pretended like this was no big deal. February 18th. I stayed in this morning. I said it was because the book I was reading was so interesting, but of course that was a lie. We had lunch, and then John and I went out while he did his skiing. I thought he'd never get tired, but after a half hour or so, he was ready to go back in. I think by next week, Mom will let him go out on his own. We went back to the house together. I ran in, got the skates, took the skis and the shoes and the poles from John, and said I'd be home in a couple of hours. And then I did what no other athlete has done before. I won 2 Olympic gold medals in 2 different sports in the same afternoon. First, I won the cross-country ski race. I went from home to Miller's Pond and won by so much I couldn't even see my competitors. But that was just a warm-up. When I got to the pond, I skated my legendary gold medal-winning long program. I could hear the thousands of people in the stands cheering my every move. My crossovers, my mohawks, my spiral, my spins, my breathtaking single toe loop, my Ina Bauer, the brilliantly choreographed, seemingly spontaneous footwork sequence. The ice was showered with flowers and teddy bears. The TV commentators said they were honored to be in the arena to see such a performance. I wiped away a tear or two in the kiss and cry. Every one of my competitors came up to me and congratulated me on the skate of the century. I stood proudly on the podium as the American flag went up. I smiled and sang along to the Star-Spangled Banner. America's darling, the greatest athlete in American history, and a shoo-in for 8 gold medals in swimming at the next Summer Olympics. Did you have a good time? Mom asked when I got back from the pond. The best, I told her. February 20th. Johnny, why haven't you eaten any supper? Mom asked him this evening. I'm not hungry, he said. That's the 3rd day in a row he hasn't been hungry at supper time. I guess he went into the pantry when none of us were looking. I guess he knows now what the rest of us figured out already. I wonder if he's noticed that Mom's hardly eating anything. February 22nd. We were all asleep when suddenly noises woke us up. Noises and light. I think we all woke up disoriented. The only noise we ever hear is each other and the wind. And light comes only from the wood stove, candles, oil lamps, and flashlights. This was a different kind of noise, a different kind of light. Matt figured it out first. It's electricity, he said. We have electricity. We leaped off our mattresses and ran through the house. The overhead light was on in the kitchen. A long-forgotten radio was broadcasting static in the living room. The clock radio was flashing the time in my bedroom. Mom had the good sense to look at her watch. It was 2:05 a.m. By 2:09, the electricity was off. But we all can't help thinking, if it came on once, it'll come on again. February 24th. You know, Mom said at lunch today, that little burst of electricity got me thinking. Me too, I said, about washing machines and dryers. Computers, John said. DVD players. Refrigerators, Matt said. Electric heaters. Yes, all of that, Mom said. But what I was really thinking about was radio. All we got was static, Matt pointed out. But if we have electricity, maybe other places have it too, and radio stations are broadcasting again, Mom said. And we don't need electricity to find that out. We should turn on a radio and see if we can get any stations. For a moment, I wanted to tell Mom not to try, that the whole world had probably died from the flu, and we were the last ones left on Earth. I think that sometimes. But then, I realized someone had to have done something to give us those 4 glorious minutes of electricity. The thought of our not being alone was thrilling. I ran into the living room and got the radio. Mom's fingers actually trembled as she turned it on and tried to get a station. But all we got was static. "We'll try again tonight," she said, "after sundown." And we did. We waited all day for the sky to go from gray to black. When it finally did, Mom turned the radio on again. At first, all we heard was static. But then, we heard a man's voice.
"In Cleveland, Harvey Aaron," the man said. "Joshua Aaron, Sharon Aaron, Eben Abraham, Doris Abrams, Michael Abrams, John Aykroyd, Mary Aykroyd, Helen Atchison, Robert Atchison."
"It's a list of the dead," Matt said. "He's reading the names of the dead." "But that means people are alive," Mom said. "Someone has to be reporting who died. Someone has to be listening." She played with the dial some more.
"In other news today, the president said the country has turned the corner. Better times are predicted for the weeks to come, with life being back to normal by May."
"The idiot's still alive," Mom cried. "And he's still an idiot!" We burst out laughing. We listened to that station for a while, until we figured out it was broadcasting from Washington. Then, Mom found a third station, out of Chicago. It was broadcasting news also. Most of the news was bad, the way it had been last summer. Earthquakes, floods, volcanoes, the litany of natural disasters. There were a few things added to the list, though. Flu epidemics and cholera, famine, droughts, ice storms. But it was still news. There was life going on. We aren't alone. February 25th. Matt figured if the radio stations were back on, maybe we had phone service and just didn't know it. So he picked up the phone, but it was still dead. The only person who might be trying to reach us is Dad. Other than that, it doesn't matter. February 26th. Electricity again. This time at 1 in the afternoon, and it lasted for 10 minutes. John was outside skiing, so we missed it. "We're going to start a laundry next time," Mom said. "Whatever gets done, gets done." It's so glorious to think there could be a next time. February 27th. 12 minutes of electricity at 9:15 tonight. Mom changed her mind about the laundry. "We'll give it a try in daytime," she said. "Maybe tomorrow." February 28th. 6 minutes of electricity at 4:45 a.m. Big deal. I know I should be excited because we've had electricity 3 days in a row, but we need food more than we need electricity. A lot more. Unless electricity can make us some canned vegetables and soup and tuna fish, I don't know what good it's going to do us. I wonder who will read our names on the radio after we've died of starvation. March 3rd. No electricity for the past 2 days. We were better off without any electricity. Why did they have to give us the taste of it just to take it away? Mom listens to the radio for half an hour every evening. I don't know why. She goes from station to station. We're up to 6 now. And all they broadcast is bad news. No, that's not true. They broadcast bad news and the president saying things are looking up. I don't know which is worse. It scares me a little that Mom is willing to burn up batteries just to listen to the radio. I think it's her way of accepting that there's no point in the batteries outliving us. March 4th. Matt had been up to 10 stairs, and I was sure by the end of this week he'd be climbing the whole staircase. But today, he only did 6 stairs. I know because I tiptoed behind him and peeked through the living room door. Mom knew that's what I was doing, and she didn't tell me not to. John was outside, but even he's down to 20 minutes skiing. I don't think Matt knows I was spying on him. I got back to the sunroom before he did, and I was real quiet. Mom hardly spoke all afternoon. Matt got back on his mattress and slept for 2 hours. Not even John walking back in woke him. Sometimes, I think about everything I went through when they were all sick, and it makes me so angry. How dare they die now?
March 5th. It snowed all day. At least we could watch it through the window in the sunroom. I don't think we got more than 4 or 5 inches, and Matt pointed out it was good to have fresh snow for drinking water. Mom's told me not to bother washing the sheets for a while. I guess I should be glad, since the sheets are my least favorite thing to wash. They're just so big. She says it's because if we get electricity back for good, it'll be so much easier to wash the sheets that way. But I think it's because she's worried I burn up too much energy washing things that bulky. I finally figured I should know the worst, and I checked out the pantry. I wish I hadn't. March 6th. John was outside, and Matt was sleeping this afternoon. Mom gestured to me, and we went into the living room. "I hate to ask this of you," she said, "but do you think you could skip lunch a couple of times a week?" Mom's been eating every other day for a couple of weeks now, so she was asking less of me than what she's doing herself. "Okay," I said. What was I supposed to say? "I want Matt and Johnny to still eat every day," she said. "Can you live with that?" I burst out laughing. Even Mom grinned. "Bad choice of words," she said. "I apologize." "It's okay," I said. I even kissed her to prove I meant it. I think Mom figures John still has the best chance of surviving, and I think she can't bear the idea of seeing Matt die. Neither can I. Better Mom should go first, then me, then Matt. Matt will see to it John makes it through. March 7th. This is so stupid. I started looking at this diary and all its empty pages. I was so excited when Mom gave it to me at Christmas. I even worried I'd finish it up by April and have to go back to the blue books. So many empty pages. March 8th. Electricity again. This time for 16 minutes, around 3 this afternoon. I don't know what that means. March 12th. Mom fainted this afternoon. I don't think she's eaten in 3 days. I made some soup and forced her to eat it. I'm not ready for her to die yet. I did another inventory of the pantry. There's so little in there, it didn't take much time for me to check. There's maybe 2 weeks' worth of food, if only John and Matt eat. With Mom and me eating occasionally, we'll run out of food in 10 days. If after we die Matt stops eating, then John gets another few days, which could give him enough time and strength to get out of here. Matt can tell him who to go to, so he can barter any leftover firewood for food. I wonder what John will do with Horton. March 13th. The four of us shared a can of tomato soup for lunch. Then Mom insisted Matt and John share the last can of mixed vegetables. It might be easier for Mom and me if we stopped eating altogether. We only had a couple of sips of soup anyway, just enough to remind me what food tastes like. My birthday's next week. If I'm still alive, I hope Mom will be too. March 14th. Nearly an hour of electricity this morning. I stupidly looked at myself in a mirror when the lights were on. For a moment, I actually didn't recognize myself. Then I remembered what I look like. Not that it matters. Who cares what a corpse looks like? March 16th. I dreamed last night that I went into a pizza parlor. Sitting there were Dad, Lisa, and a little girl who I knew right away was Rachel. I slid into the booth. The smells, tomato sauce, garlic, cheeses, were overwhelming. "Is this heaven?" I asked. "No," Dad said. "It's a pizza parlor." I think the dream gave me an idea, but it's hard to tell what's an idea and what's nonsense when you can't even tell the difference between heaven and a pizza parlor. Chapter 21. March 17th. By the time I fell asleep last night, I knew what I was going to have to do today. The only question was, would I have the strength? But when I woke up, I saw Mom struggle to get off her mattress, as though she needed to be up and around to do things for us.
and that made up my mind for me. After Matt and John rose, and we all pretended like today was just another day, no harder than any we've been through, I made my announcement. "I'm going into town," I said. They stared at me like I was truly crazy. They were probably right. "I'm going to the post office," I said. "I want to see if there's any word from Dad." "What difference does it make?" John asked. "You think he sent us food?" "I want to know if Lisa had her baby," I said. "I need to know that. I need to know that life is continuing. I'm going to town and find out."
"Miranda, can we talk?" Matt asked.
I nodded, since I knew someone was going to question me about this, and it might as well be him. We left the others in the sunroom and went to the living room to talk privately.
"Do you really think you have the strength to make it to town and back?" he asked.
I wanted to say no, of course I don't, and we both know it, and that's one reason why I'm going. I wanted to say, "Stop me, because if I'm going to die, I want to die at home." I wanted to say, "How could you have let this happen to me?" as though it was Matt's fault and he could have saved us somehow. None of which I said.
"I know it's crazy," I said instead, "but I really need to know if Lisa had the baby. I feel like it's okay for me to die if she did. And maybe the post office is open, and maybe there is a letter. How much longer can I last anyway? A week? Two? I'm willing to lose a few days for peace of mind. You understand that, don't you? But if you can, you will come back," he said after a long pause.
"I hope I can," I said. "I'd rather be here. But if I can't, that's okay too."
"What about Mom?" he asked.
"I've thought about that," I said. "I think this is actually better for her. If I don't come back, she can always have hope that I'm okay. I don't want her to see me die, and I don't know that I can outlive her. This is really best, Matt. I thought about it a lot, and this is the best."
Matt looked away.
"I'm sorry," he said. "But what about the skis? John's going to need them after we're gone."
Well, that was it, wasn't it? I was leaving home to give Johnny just a little better chance. We were starving ourselves to give Johnny just a little better chance. If I really wanted him to have that chance, then I'd better accept that this casual stroll to town was meant to kill me. In which case, I didn't need the skis.
"I'll leave them behind," I said. "Tell John they'll be behind the oak tree, and he should get them right after I leave. But don't tell Mom unless she asks. Let her think I'm coming back, okay?"
"You don't have to do this," Matt said.
"I know," I said, and kissed him goodbye. "And I love you and Johnny and Mom more than I ever knew. Now let me go in and say goodbye while I still have the nerve." So I did. Mom was so weak I don't think she really understood what was going on. She just told me to get back before dark, and I said I would. John looked like he had 1,000 questions, but Matt wouldn't let him start. I kissed him and Mom and told them to leave a light on for me, like that had any meaning. I rammed a pen in one of the blue books into my coat pocket. Then I went to the front door, picked up Dad's shoes, skis, and poles, and walked to the road. When I got to the oak tree, I carefully placed everything where no one from the road could see them. Then I started the walk to town. I wanted desperately to turn around, see the house, say goodbye, but I didn't let myself. I was scared that if I allowed myself that moment of weakness, I would race back in, and what good would that do any of us? Did I really need to be alive on my birthday? Did I even want to be, if Mom died between now and then? So I kept my eyes straight ahead and began the journey. For the first mile, footing wasn't too bad, since John and I had skied there and compacted the snow. Sure, I fell a few times where the snow was ice-like, but I managed. I told myself the rest of the trip wouldn't be too bad, and there was hope I could get to town, maybe even find a letter from Dad, and get home again. I liked telling myself that. But the next 2 miles were brutal. I don't think anyone had walked on it since Christmas. I found I couldn't walk after a while, so I sat on the snow and pushed myself forward, half rowing, half sledding. It took all my strength to go a few feet, and the harder I worked, the more I yearned to give up and let myself die then and there. But I pictured the pizza parlor and Dad telling me they weren't in heaven. If there was a letter, I wanted to know. Death could wait a few more hours. I felt a lot better when I got to a spot where I could walk upright again. I was soaking wet by that point and freezing cold. But being on my own 2 feet gave me a sense of dignity and purpose. It made me feel human again, and that gave me some strength back. One of the scariest things was seeing how very few houses had smoke coming out of their chimneys. It wasn't like I could go to any of them and say, "Rescue me, feed my family," because all they'd do was throw me out. We would have done the same if anyone came to our door. But to see so many houses with no signs of life. Some people I knew had simply left while that was still possible. But others must have died from the flu, or the cold, or the hunger. We were all still alive, Mom and Matt and Johnny and me. And I'd left a record. People would know I had lived. That counted for a lot. The closer I got to town, the easier it was to walk. But the closer I got to town, the fewer signs of life I saw. It made sense. The people there lived closer together, so they shoveled their snow, at least in the beginning. But they were also less likely to have wood stoves, and more likely to have frozen to death. The closer they lived, the faster the flu would have spread. Our isolation had saved us, given us weeks, maybe even months more life. By the time I got near enough to see the post office, I was starting to feel like I could make it back home. I knew that was madness, that the road was uphill and I had no strength left for that part where I wouldn't be able to walk. It's one thing to push yourself downhill, but pushing yourself uphill would be impossible. My heart would give out, and I'd die a couple of miles from home. But I didn't care. I'd made it to town, and that was all I planned for. I'd go to the post office and find word from Dad that he and Lisa and baby Rachel were alive and well. Then, it wouldn't matter where I died or how. Johnny would live, and so would Rachel, and that was what counted. It was eerie standing on the main street of town, seeing no one, hearing no one, smelling nothing but the stench of death. I saw the carcasses of dogs and cats, pets people had left behind that couldn't survive in the cold without food. I bent down and clawed at one to see if there was any meat left, but what little clung to the skeleton was too frozen to pry off. I threw it back down onto the snow-covered street and felt relieved I didn't see any human bodies. Then I got to the post office and saw it was dead too. I felt such despair. It was probable the post office had never reopened since that last day Matt had worked there. Any fantasy I'd had that the reason I'd left the sunroom was to find a letter from Dad floated out of me. I'd gone to town to die. There was no point going home, forcing the others to watch that happen. I sank onto the ground. What was the point? Why should I even try to get back to the house? The kindest thing I could do would be to stay here where I was and let the coldness kill me. Mrs. Nesbitt had known how to die. Couldn't I learn that from her? But then, I saw a glimpse of yellow. My world has been nothing but shades of gray for so long that the yellow almost hurt my eyes. But something was yellow. I remembered yellow as the color of sun. I'd seen the sun last July. It hurt to look straight at it, and it hurt to look at this new burst of yellow. It wasn't the sun. I laughed at myself for thinking it might be. It was a sheet of paper dancing in the crosswinds down the street. But it was yellow. I had to have it. I forced myself to stand up and chase the sheet of paper. It taunted me with its dance, but I outwitted it, and with all my remaining strength, put my foot over it and pinned it to the sidewalk. I bent down and felt the world swirling around me as I picked it up and stood straight. Just holding it made me excited. There were words. This was a message. Someone, sometime, had said something, and now I would know what it was. City Hall, open Fridays, 2 to 4 p.m. There was no date, no way of knowing when it had been posted or why. But the words told me where to go. I had nothing to lose. Any dreams I might have had died with the post office. If City Hall were closed also, It made no difference. So I began the walk to City Hall. It was only a couple of blocks away from the post office. I looked at my watch and saw I had half an hour before it would close, assuming it was even open. But when I got there, the door was unlocked, and I could hear voices. "Hello," I said, proud of myself that I remembered the word. "Come on in," a man said. He opened an office door and waved me in. "Hi," I said, like this was the most normal thing in the world. "I'm Miranda Evans. I live on Howell Bridge Road." "Sure," he said. "Come in. I'm Mayor Ford, and this is Tom Danworth. Pleased to meet you."
"You too," I said, trying to believe that this wasn't a dream.
"Come here to sign up for your food?" Mayor Ford asked.
"Food?" I said. "I can get food?"
It had to be a dream. "See," Mr. Danworth said. "That's why we're not getting many takers. Nobody knows." "Lot of death up Howell Bridge Way," Mayor Ford said. "No reason to go out there. How many in your family, Miranda?"
"Four," I said. "My mom and brothers had the flu, but they all lived. Can I get food for them, too?"
"We'll need a witness they're still alive," the mayor said. "But everyone's entitled to one bag of food a week. That's what we've been told, and that's what we're doing." "Program's been going on for 4 weeks now," Mr. Danworth said. "So this young lady is entitled to at least four bags."
If it was a dream, I didn't want to wake up.
"Tell you what," the mayor said. "Wait until four when we officially close, and Tom here will take you home on the snowmobile. You and your four bags, that is. And he'll check out your story, and if what you say is true, then next Monday we'll send someone out to your home with food for the rest of your folk. Monday's delivery day. How does that sound?"
"I don't believe it," I said. "Real food?"
The mayor laughed. "Well, not gourmet," he said. "Not like we used to get at McDonald's. But canned goods and some boxed stuff. Nobody's been complaining."
I didn't know what to say. I just walked over to him and hugged him.
"Skin and bones," he said to Mr. Danworth. "Guess she got here just in time."
We waited around for the next 15 minutes, but no one showed up. Finally, the mayor told Mr. Danworth to get the four bags from the storage room and take them to the snowmobile. I longed to go through the bags, see what kind of wonders were inside them, but I knew that would only slow things down. Besides, what did it matter? It was food. Four bags of food. For a whole week, we wouldn't be hungry. What had taken me 3 hours was a 20-minute trip in the snowmobile. It felt like flying, watching the houses whiz by. Mr. Danworth drove the snowmobile right to the sunroom door. The noise had obviously startled everybody, because they were all standing by the door when I knocked.
"Well, I guess you were telling the truth," Mr. Danworth said. "I definitely see three people here, and they all look mighty hungry."
"I'll help you bring in the bags," I said. It was incredibly important to me to do that, to be the one bringing in the food that was going to save us.
"Fair enough," he said, "but let me help." He ended up carrying in three bags to my one, but it didn't matter.
Then he gave Mom a piece of paper to sign saying there were four of us in need of food.
"We'll be back on Monday," he said. "I can't guarantee you'll get all 12 bags you're entitled to, but we should manage seven, three for this week and four for next. After that, you can count on four bags a week, at least until you hear otherwise."
Mom was sobbing. Matt managed to shake Mr. Danworth's hand and thank him.
John was too busy pouring through the bags and holding things up for all of us to see.
"You take care," Mr. Danworth said. "The worst is over.
You made it this far. You'll make it all the way."
"Can we have supper tonight?" John asked after Mr. Danworth left. "Please, Mom. Just this once." Mom wiped away her tears, took a deep breath, and smiled. "Tonight we eat," she said.
"And tomorrow and Sunday we'll eat."
We had sardines and mushrooms and rice for supper. For dessert, we had dried fruit. The electricity came on for the second time today while we were eating. This may be a fool's paradise, but it's paradise nonetheless. March 18th.
The electricity came on while we were feasting on chickpeas, lentils, and carrots. Come on, Mom said. Let's try a laundry. And we did. It was kind of a challenge because we don't have running water, so we had to pour water into the machine for the wash and rinse cycles. But even so, it was still much easier than doing it by hand. We washed all our sheets, and the electricity stayed on for most of the clothes dryer time. We celebrated by washing our hair. We took turns shampooing everyone else. Moms insisted we sponge bathe daily, but shampoos are a real treat. Then tonight, the electricity came back on, only for 10 minutes or so, but we didn't care. We made supper in the microwave. Supper in the microwave. The most beautiful words I've ever written. March 19th. We still have 3 bags of food in the pantry, but I can tell Mom's nervous about tomorrow. It's like the electricity. It comes and goes, but you can't count on it. Still, even if the food's that way, we can make sure John's strong and well-fed, and that will give Mom peace. March 20th. My birthday. I'm 17, and I'm alive, and we have food. Mr. Danworth himself showed up this morning with 10 bags of food. We know you're owed more, but this'll have to do, he said. See you next Monday with your regular 4 bags. There was so much, and it was all so wonderful. Powdered milk, cranberry juice, 3 cans of tuna fish. Well, I could write it all down, but it doesn't matter. It was food, and it will get us through for weeks, and there will be more food to come. Because it was my birthday, Mom let me decide what we were going to have. I found a box of macaroni and cheese. It was as close to pizza as I could get. There's still so much we don't know. We can only hope Dad and Lisa and baby Rachel are alive. Grandma, too. Sammy and Dan and all the other people we knew who left here. The flu was all over the U.S., probably all over the world. We were lucky to survive that. Most people weren't. The electricity comes and goes, so we don't know when we'll be able to depend on it. We have firewood for a while yet, and Matt is getting stronger. He walked up 10 stairs today, and only Mom's insistence kept him from climbing them all. There's plenty of snow outside, so we're okay for water. The sky is still gray, though, and even though the temperature's been above 0 for a week now, 20 degrees still feels balmy. But today isn't a day to worry about the future. Whatever will happen, will happen. Today is a day to celebrate. Tomorrow, there will be more daylight than night. Tomorrow, I'll wake up and find my mother and my brothers by my side. All still alive. All still loving me. A while ago, Johnny asked me why I was still keeping a journal, who I was writing it for. I've asked myself that a lot, especially in the really bad times. Sometimes I've thought I'm keeping it for people 200 years from now, so they can see what our lives were like. Sometimes I've thought I'm keeping it for that day when people no longer exist, but butterflies can read. But today, when I am 17, and warm, and well-fed, I'm keeping this journal for myself, so I can always remember life as we knew it. Life as we know it. For a time when I am no longer in the sunroom. This is Emily Bauer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Life as We Knew It by Susan Beth Pfeffer. This program was produced and directed by Paul Rubin. Executive producer, Jacob Bronstein. Text copyright 2006 by Susan Beth Pfeffer. Production copyright 2006, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.